This is Radio West. I'm producer Benjamin Bombard. As you can probably guess, being a public radio producer means hours and hours in front of a computer. And for a long time, for me, that meant hours and hours sitting in an office chair. But that all changed in 2013 when we had Dr. James Levine on the show. Dr. Levine had a simple but provocative message. Our bodies aren't evolved to sit, he said, and sitting is slowly killing us. What we need to do is get off our butts, stand, walk, move around, do anything but sit. So I took his advice. Sure, I still spend hours in front of the computer, but it's been 6 years since there's been a chair in my office, and honestly, I've never felt healthier. Dr. Levine's case for the dangers of inactivity might even convince you to ditch the chair, too. Here's the conversation.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Right at the beginning of his book, Dr. James Levine points out that polite invitation that we almost always offer a guest, have a seat, take a load off. But for 20 years, Levine has been exploring just what that means to have a seat, the physiological effect of sitting down, something our bodies, by the way, aren't really designed to do. Levine says when you understand what sitting does to the electric activity in your muscles, what it means for insulin and enzyme productivity, and the association between sitting and dying early, the more polite invitation just might be, please stand, or better yet, let's go for a walk. Today in the program, we're talking about the effects of all of this sitting that we're doing these days. We'll discuss what it's doing to our bodies, but also how we got this way and what you do to change your mindset and re-engineer your environment at home and at work. Dr. James Levine is the director of the Obesity Solutions Initiative. It's a joint effort of Arizona State University and the Mayo Clinic in Scottsdale, Arizona. I mentioned his book. It's called Move a Little, Lose a Lot. And he's joining us today from a studio in Phoenix, Arizona. And Dr. James Levine, welcome. Thank you very much for being with us.
Good morning, Doug. How are you?
Fine, thanks. Well, I wanted to start some of the things you write in your book about how you first became inspired. You've been writing about this, thinking about this a long time, but you do tell this particular story, which is, I guess, in some way kind of an epiphany you had when you were in Mexico at this hotel. You met a barman there. And it kind of got you inspired. Would you tell that story if you would?
Wow, that takes me back a long, long time, a couple of decades. I was out at a conference actually invited by the government, and it'd been another long day. I'd been sitting in committee rooms from about 8 in the morning till 7 at night, and I finally came back to the hotel. And of course, what's the first thing you do? You go downstairs to sit some more, and I was sitting at the bar. And the gentleman who was the bartender was just the most, he just effervesced life. Mm. And we were talking and he said, hi, sir, how's your day? And I sort of told him what I've just told you. And I said something clear. I sort of said to him, well, tell me about your day.
Yeah.
And he said, yeah, well, I got up at about, 10 o'clock. I took the kids to school. Then I actually went and met my cousins and we played soccer for an hour. I met my wife for lunch, and then my shift started at 2 this afternoon.
Right.
And we started talking, and as he was telling me about his life and how he interacted with his kids and his wife, it became like an epiphany moment. Of course, he got paid 10 times less than I did, but his quality of life was 10 times more. And as soon as I heard that, and as soon as I just saw the joy and the spring in his step. And I realized I was on the wrong path.
And you say it inspired you to kind of re-engineer your life environment, your work environment. You lost a lot of weight. made you happier too, I suppose.
As this was going on, because in a way, what he was telling me was, rather than sort of chasing this sort of, if you like, this sort of false hope of joy through, unending endeavor, the trial to acquire wealth that really doesn't benefit society beyond oneself, that to me was, I need to think about my own life differently.
Right.
When it actually came to the fact that I had gained 25 pounds in a year and a half, spotted, of course, by my wife, who said to me, in terms that I may paraphrase for your audience, okay. You know, Jim, you're gaining a lot of weight. Please, honey, do something about it.
Yeah.
You know, that was the epiphany. And at the same time, of course, from the laboratory, we were seeing data. Mm-hmm. And you can't, you know, I had a personal thrust to get up and move. I had an awakening that somehow my life was on the wrong path. I couldn't quite put my finger on it. And then we had the data from the lab. And the data from the lab were irrefutable. You sit too much, it's bad, not just for obesity and gaining those 25 pounds that I had. I actually already had pre-diabetes, and that terrified me because my grandma had that too. And I realized that there had to be a better way of living.
We're going to get to some of that data as we go along. But I wanted to ask you about you write about how you've been fascinated by human energy for as long as you can remember. And I want to know why. What is it about that? Because you tell this kind of remarkable story. You say when you were 10 years old,
correct,
you started these experiments that have sort of come to be this book and your life's work. What is it about human energy that fascinates you so much?
So, Doug, you're not just taking me back 20 years. You're yeah. taking me back. I don't want to say to you, to explain exactly how old. I'm 49. So you're taking me back a long time.
Yeah.
So, perhaps, you know, some kids parties. Some kids are out in the parks. I was in my bedroom building tanks. And they weren't fish tanks. They were kind of like fish tanks, but only 2.5 inches thick. And I literally went and bought the glass from a glazier. I sort of put all this together. These things, I have to tell you, continuously leaked. So I had like little pots underneath these very, very thin 4-foot-long fish tanks. And in these very thin fish tanks, I went to the park, which was Regent's Park, and gathered pond snails. And I knew, you know, Maggie from Johnny because of the markings on the shell, so I could identify which snail was which. And these snails lived under my bed. And every night before I went to sleep, I'd take one of these snails, identify who it was, and put him or her, by the way, snails are hermaphrodite,
right.
but bear with me on this one,
of course.
Put him or her on the inside of in the very, very thin tank. And then I would set my alarm clock. And every hour I would wake up during the night and mark on the glass with an X where the snail had moved. Now, I had this idea. I feel very, you can't see me, of course, but I'm blushing. I had this idea as a kid that Maggie would always have the same pattern of movement. She would always be swirly-whirly, whereas snail Jonathan would always move in straight lines. And so that was my idea. And I gathered 174 overnight tracings of snails.
Wow.
And what? And I can only tell you the moment when I showed them to the headmaster of my school, the principal of my school. Anyway, and suffice it to say a psychologist was involved.
Right.
Anyway, what was really, really interesting is that I was completely wrong, but I was kind of right. So Maggie didn't always have the same path. She didn't always go swirly, swirly, swirly. But what was really interesting was that if Maggie was jiggedy, in other words, she sort of had zigzaggy types of movements, regardless of the path she took, she was always zigzaggy. And similarly, Paul or Jonathan, let's say, Jonathan, if he was a straight line snail, he would always move in a very, very straight line and not be jiggedy. So at that point, I was thinking to myself, why on earth is it that somehow in the brains of these snails, their movement seems to be so biochemically defined? And I would actually lie in the bath as a kid and calculate my rate of heat loss to the water as the water cooled.
Wow.
And then I would do the and so you get the gist, is you know, here is a man with his path predetermined in some respect to try and understand what is happening with human movement.
I love how passionate you are about this, because you call this your life's work, your calling, this idea of metabolism and energy. But this is it. I mean, to call it a calling, I think is great.
But I suppose, Doug, on the other hand, zoom forwards, if I may, please, 40 years.
Yeah.
So I get off an international aeroplane trip to the UK and drive straight from the airport. It's about 4:30 to one of the corporations we're delivering these programs to. Mm-hmm. I come in and, you know, I'm sure many of your listeners appreciate, you know, you're jet lagged, you're feeling miserable, you need to have a shower, so to speak. You know, and all of those, you feel that sort of grungy feel. So I walk into this office, and as I walk in, I look up, and there, walking around the office on a trail they've laid out on the floor with tape, is a lady who I know is a marathon runner having a walk-and-talk meeting with somebody who is about 150 pounds overweight. These two people are walking congenially. They're discussing their business, of course, and they see me and both rush across this office space and give me a hug, saying, "We weren't expecting you today. We thought you were coming in tomorrow." Now, the pleasure and joy, forget the health benefits for now, that one sees, that I get to see, and Shelley and Gabe and the whole team at Mayo and all of us get to see almost every day that we deliver these programs, I assure you, makes a life mission worthwhile. As people get up and move, they become happier, they become joyous, they become invigorated, they become impassioned. And so, yeah, this may well be my life's calling, but it is so joyous and fulfilling, I cannot begin to express to you.
Mm. You write in your book that sitting used to be kind of a break in the day. Now you describe it as the singular way we spend most of our time. And you get people to reflect on a typical day. Describe mm-hmm. what that is for the vast majority of us.
Well, I have this theory. We sort of did, again, we've sort of studied a lot of this at a level of intensity many individuals could not quite imagine.
Right.
So suffice it to say, it is quite possible to use 70 tools of convenience between waking up in the morning and actually getting to work. And I'll just pattern out what I mean by this. So, for example, you sort of want, you know, you roll out of bed and you sort of hit the snooze button on the clock radio.
Right.
Many of your listeners can't even remember winding up a clock.
Right.
We roll out of bed and we hit the on button on the coffee grinder. Who remembers those hand-turning right. things for grinding your coffee, right?
Yeah.
You then hit the on button on the coffee maker. Who remembers taking one of those things you used to sort of screw together and put water in the bottom, the percolators, and water would sort of steam out everywhere and coffee would go... Then you knew it was ready. Do you remember those?
Yeah.
I think you're too young, but I do. And then you've, of course... You know, we use the cell phone, which is right in our pocket rather than across the room. Of course, we use the remote control to switch on the TV apart from walking across. Then, of course, we get into the car. And yes, inevitably, we drive through the bank to get a little bit of cash. And then we drive through the fast food restaurant because we're so busy, perhaps dropping our kids off at school or, you know, or just rushing to work. The intensity is so great for so many, many, many of my patients. And so then you sort of get to the car park. And of course, it's specifically designed to get you into work quicker. You're taking up the elevator, switching on your email. Does anyone even remember opening the mail as the first thing as part of your work day? Of course we don't. We remember logging on,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
To me, logging on is something you actually do on a log in a forest with your kids
right.
as a fun activity, right? And so if you start to contemplate how tremendously infused our world has become to stop us using our bodies to serve the human need, it is immediately apparent that we sort of become seduced into this entirety of inactivity.
Mm.
And that degree, and the contemplation doesn't need to be that deep because it is immediately obvious. I mean, I've had the pleasure, and I will tell you, an incredible honor to work with the United Nations in the Ivory Coast, in Africa, in China before modernization came there. And you see people living, and we did these amazing studies in agricultural parts of Jamaica as well.
Yeah.
And you see how people were kind of designed to live, where the default was up and moving and smiling, and the rest was to sit. When you rested, you sat. Now, of course, in modern society, we all recognize that the default is on your bottom.
You know, I wanted to ask you about that, those farm workers study you did in Jamaica, because I found this was, I liked how explicit this was as a comparison. So the farm workers in Jamaica, they averaged 5,000 daily movements, only 300 minutes of sitting. How does that compare to, you know, the average office schlub like me?
Doug, I would never describe you as an office schlub.
I do a lot of sitting, I'll be honest.
At very best, we'll call you a sitter. How about
that?
Okay, good.
That would be
better. Okay. So, I mean, what's really interesting is, so the first comparison we made was these individuals living in agricultural parts of Jamaica who were moving 5,000 movement units, as you say. And we compared that to individuals who had migrated into Kingston, into the main city, of course, who had now taken on office jobs. And what we saw is the amount of movement, listen to this, halved, literally halved, and the amount of sitting doubled. Now, what we then did is compare those individuals who understandably are lean at this point in time to lean individuals working in schlub jobs, sitting jobs, let's call them, sedentary jobs, jobs we can all identify with in America. Lean individuals working in sedentary jobs in Kingston sit the same amount of time as lean individuals working in sedentary jobs in America. And so, therefore, we understood that, if you like, the natural capability of the human, forgetting obesity, forgetting weight gain and diabetes and all that other stuff, the natural way of the human is to move literally twice as much as even fit, lean individuals living in America, sitting half as much. And so you get the sense that that we're not talking about sort of subtle changes in how the human body is asked to respond to a change and an evolution in modern society. No, we're talking about a fundamental difference, a halving of the amount of movement that we now endure compared to what we are probably meant to endure.
I wanted to make a reference to another study that you write about in your book. There was this study done of this old order Amish community, and the average man in that community logged 9 miles. It's 18,000 steps every day. Now, they weren't exercising, of course. They weren't running a marathon. This was just doing the chores. The average woman in that community logged 7 miles. Now, compare that to the office sitter, typical guy like me. The average man and woman logs 5,000 to 6,000 steps. 18,000 steps compared to 5,000 steps. That's remarkable.
And you're absolutely correct. And you're seeing, therefore, my goodness, isn't it unusual that science agrees with itself, right? Yeah. I mean, what you're actually seeing here is a very consistent message, is the changes in activity and sitting behavior, the decline in activity and the increase in sitting behavior that have occurred with our modern lives isn't subtle. It's not a little bit of this and a little bit of that. You're talking, in those data, a threefold difference. In the data that we directly measured in Jamaica, a twofold difference. You know, it's sort of like if I said to you, you know, Doug, I'm going to double your savings account. You're going to say, my goodness, do it right now. That's huge. Or if I say, conversely, I'm going to halve it. Oh, please. You know, these are massive, massive differences. And the human body is, if you like, has evolved over a very, very long period of time to be a mobile and dynamic entity. And so, if you like, condensing the human body into a chair has inevitable harmful effects. And sure, it's taken us, you know, several generations of modernization to realize it, but those harmful effects are here and they're here now.
We're going to talk about, as we go, the effects, the actual physiological effects on the body. But I want to introduce this concept that you write about that has become your life's work, as you say, NEAT, non-exercise activity thermogenesis, which, of course, sounds really pretentious and complicated, but you mentioned how incredibly simple it is. Talk about this concept, if you would.
Oh, with pleasure. we have 3.5 hours, right, Doug?
Right.
So NEAT is non-exercise exercise activity thermogenesis. And what that actually means, and again, let's just say non-exercise activity. So the first thing is we're not talking about going to the gym.
Right.
And I tell you, I take my hat off to people who go to the gym, but I'm just not one of them. And I'm not one of them, not because I'm lazy or I'm poorly motivated. It's just that is not my cup of tea. That's an English expression. So NEAT is non-exercise activity. It is the activities that we do throughout the day that are not exercise and not sitting and sleeping. So it is all of that movement we do throughout the day. And initially, the media referred to this as the fidget factor. Yes, it includes fidgeting. But more importantly than that, Doug, it is sort of, you know, getting up and going to the bathroom,
right,
waiting in line at the post office. If you happen to be working in a supermarket, it's the movement you do as you move around the supermarket. It is all of that non-exercise activity that you do throughout the day. The thermogenesis refers to the calorie burn.
Right.
Because, and I'm telling you, when we actually have people in our Mayo labs and they do this, this is the aha moment. If you take somebody who's sitting and you get them up and you put them on a treadmill at 1 mile an hour, one of our research subjects, at 1 mile an hour. Now, 1 mile an hour is what I call shopping speed. And I don't mean internet shopping. I mean, if you're in a store and you're ambling through looking at dresses or pants or whatever it may be, that's 1 mile an hour.
Yeah.
So super slow.
Right.
What that does is that doubles your metabolic rate. It doubles your metabolic rate, 100 calories an hour. And so very, very low levels of non-exercise activity have the potential to burn hundreds and hundreds of calories because we have the potential for doing them all waking hours. Mm. So if I was to convert, you know, just imagine a single, I'm having this, as I'm talking to you now, Doug, I'm standing and I'm pacing around inside this booth here. So for this interview, I'm going to burn 150 calories. Now, I could just as easily have talking to you sitting. Now, if I were to do that 4 hours for my day, which of course I'm going to do, you know me well enough already, that is four times 150, which is 600 calories. Now, that's 600 calories without breaking a sweat, without going to the gym, without leaving work, without paying a penny. And that's NEAT. That is the power of NEAT. People can burn 600, 700, 800, 900 extra calories a day without breaking a sweat. And that's the sort of the driving ethos, the driving philosophy of the NEAT program.
Well, give us a sense, Dr. Levine, what happens when you sit down? I mean, what's going on? I guess this is about energy, right? And so all the energy stops. Well, what happens? What's happening when we're sitting down?
Yeah. So first of all, yes, indeed. At the first, it's sort of, if you sort of have a, you know, Doug, if you're sitting in your Ferrari and the car is at, and the lights are at red and your Ferrari is idling, right? If you let it idle all day, all month, all year long, eventually the whole thing clogs up. It wasn't built to idle. It was built to drive. And so, yes, when you sit, your body is idling. And not only is it not burning fuel, not only is it not burning energy, not only is it sort of in the position it wasn't designed to be in, but as just like in the Ferraris, it starts to gunk up. That's actually what's happening at a molecular and cellular level in the body as well. So, for example, within 90 seconds, the gene systems in the muscle that regulate how the body responds to insulin, which of course drives sugar out of the blood into the muscular system, is altered, is negatively affected by sitting within 90 seconds. The triglycerides in the blood, which is sort of part of that cholesterol panel we all get measured from time to time by our docs, the triglycerides, when you sit, go up, and in fact, within minutes of getting up and moving, they start to decline again. And so sitting is about low energy, and that low energy
I would politely suggest is also related to low mental energy, that sort of feeling of sluggishness that most of us get at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Yeah. But on top of that, there are a cascade, and I mean cascade, of metabolic downregulation steps that basically reflect the muscles, the body fat, the liver gunking up with fuel that should have been burnt by the body that was meant to move.
Mm. I wanted to say something, or have you say something about the studies that show that, and I don't want to be too sensational about this, but I mean, it does make a very important point, that show you're going to die earlier if you do too much sitting. It's really serious, this stuff.
Again, and you're absolutely right. And there have now been numerous studies, in fact, from numerous countries that show that excessive sitting, if you like, the longer you sit, the more. And again, I don't want to upset my patients, the audience, because you're right. There's sort of a slightly negative connotation. But at the end of it, let me put a positive spin on it. But yes, you're correct. So if you sit too much, an individual is more prone to hypertension, to diabetes, to cardiovascular disease, to joint problems, sleep disorders, cancers, and premature mortality. I mean, we literally shave years off our lifespan by sitting too much. But the other way I would very politely spin that is to say that for every hour you sit, 2 hours of life are walking away.
Wow.
Now, that to me creates in my, because every time I think about it, my goodness, I want to go for a walk. You know, in my own mind, that creates to me is that for every hour you're sitting is an opportunity to be up and healthier. I mean, we know now that if you increase walking time in your day by a relatively short amount, one concomitantly decreases one's risk for breast cancer, for instance. In other words, the more you do, the better the return. And again, you don't have to go to the gym and you don't have to buy equipment and you don't need to sweat and you don't need to sort of feel that, you know, you're not the right shape for the other people who are exercising. None of that is the case with respect to this non-exercise activity, this NEAT. The whole point is that for every hour you get off your bottom, 2 hours of life are opening up before you. You know, so many opportunities, so many fantastic things. And I think that's what this brings.
Let's take a few calls. Alan is joining us in Ogden, Utah. Alan, welcome.
Hi, I just had a question. I was wondering if you've noticed in your studies any difference in patients the further away they are located away from the equator and dealing with seasonal and climate changes.
Yeah, like
what
your body.
A fantastic question. Actually, I don't have that. Well, that wasn't from our Mayo groups, but there was a one. So one of my, if I may, Doug, very, very quickly, one of my favorite, I mean, science, you know, I am honored to have worked at the Mayo Clinic for 25 years. I'm now working with Arizona State University, and the science we do as a team is beautiful, and I'm so honored to be part of it. But I assure you, and I assure your caller, that I only stand on the shoulders of giants. One of those giants I stand on are those of Andy Coward, who recently passed away, a wonderful scientist who did this kind of work in Africa. And what he discovered, in agricultural communities, is looking at the effect, just as the caller's asking about, of the effect of seasonality. And he very interestingly demonstrated that when you go through peak agricultural periods and you look at the NEAT, the non-exercise activity thermogenesis, the calories people burn, throughout the day span, it is dramatically affected by season, of course, therefore largely impacted by what's happening in the sort of the agricultural milieu, you know, planting, you know, encouraging, harvesting, that all is all hyper-energetic. But then when it comes to the downtime, the down seasons, people are far more restful throughout the day. But what I'll tell, what I may, if I may please explain, is even in those periods, in these communities that are, of course, predominantly agricultural, even then, the movement that people do throughout their day is far greater than you would see in a similar group of individuals working in modern industrialized societies.
I wanted to ask you, one of the things you point out in the book is that, yes, we no longer crank a coffee mill. We no longer wind an alarm clock. But you're not a Luddite. In fact, you describe yourself in the book as a futurist. And so there is a way, you say, to embrace all of these labor-saving devices. That's great. But there's also a way to – what it means, I guess, is just that we have to find a way to adapt to this modern world.
Agree. 100% agree. And I actually, you know, you might say that sort of in a way, you could argue that this way of looking at the world has a degree of pessimism to it. Yeah. In other words, you know, if we have evolved as a society to require people to sit behind computer screens throughout their entire workday, and then, of course, we're on the internet in the evening, you know, learning or whatever it is else we do, and so on and so forth, you might sort of say this may all be true, but there's a hopelessness to it. Mm. Doug, you are correct. I politely and passionately disagree. I think all of these modern devices, all of these modern tools, all of this brilliance that we have now the capability of developing actually are going to give us more and more and more opportunities to be up and moving and healthy throughout our day. And if I may, please, I'll give you the most simple of examples.
Yeah.
Yesterday morning at 9 a.m., I had a conference call with a colleague in New York City. And a simple example, it was a beautiful day here in Arizona, 80 degrees, and I took that conference call on my cell phone, walking outside in the shade of a building, looking at they're actually very pretty trees, and some of them are in blossom right now, and so on and so forth. And that could not have happened in the 1940s and 50s with telephone cords and so on. That could only have happened because of the cell phone. And so my point is, there are so many technological opportunities that we can deploy our modern learning and our modern approaches to bring health back to people. And you might say, well, what's, you know, okay, that might be cool, but what's the win?
Yeah.
The win here is that when you actually do that in a corporation, when you do, you know, there are all these devices now for tracking physical activity, whether it's the Groove or the Fitbit, whatever the devices may be. That is a technology. And when you deploy them in corporations, what actually happens is productivity improves but about 10 to 13%. The companies make more money. The people, the employees become healthier. And what's really cool is that if you do this in kids, their grades improve about 10% on average. So kids learn better as well. And so in a way, how I see the future, I see the future infused, if you like, with even more technology. But this technology is directly and in real time encouraging us, supporting us, facilitating us to become healthier and healthier and healthier and to get up off our bottoms and move.
When we get back from a break, we're going to be talking about some of the particular things you can do, some techniques, some strategies for getting up off your bottom, as Dr. Levine puts it. Dr. James Levine, the director of the Obesity Solutions Initiative at the Mayo Clinic and Arizona State University. He is the author of the book Move a Little, Lose a Lot. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER.
Hey again, it's Ben. During our summer hiatus, we are looking for feedback. You're the reason we make the show, after all, and we want to know what you think. Seriously, what do you like about the show? Maybe more importantly, what don't you like about it? How often do you listen? Stuff like that. It's probably no surprise that we've got a survey. To make it easy, you'll find a link to that in the description for this show. Go on, be critical. We can take it. And by the way, please tell me you're not still listening to the show sitting down. All right, here's more of Doug's conversation with Dr. James Levine.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about what it does to your body to do so much sitting, which a lot of us do a lot of during a day. Dr. James Levine is our guest. I want to talk about, Dr. Levine, some of the particular things that people can do, some ideas for getting up and moving, like, as you said, talking on your cell phone, going for a walk while you're having a conference call. But how has the office changed? Because you write a bit about this. You say even office socializing is less energetic than it used to be. So the environment itself is kind of your first obstacle, I guess.
And I think we, because our environment is something we go to work in or come home to every day, we don't hardly ever step back from our environment and sort of analyze it for what it may or may not be doing to us. I live my life on a sort of a day-to-day, almost hour-to-hour basis, and when do I ever truly step back out of my environment and sort of analyze or critically appraise what that environment is doing to me? Now, I accept that I am probably one of the most blessed people I know. I work for Mayo Clinic, Arizona State University. I couldn't work for more accommodating, more glorious employers, I assure you. And nonetheless, however, how often do I step back from that and say, how is this impacting my relationships with my kids, with my family? Am I taking enough time to, you know, expand? You know, I actually used to do a lot of volunteer work, and I've had to cut that down a lot, for instance. I mean, and that's, I think, very, very few of us ever get the opportunity or are prodded to do that. And you might say, you know, Doug, you might say, you know, why is this guy rambling on about this stuff? Because actually it's the key. What the first step is, and again, we actually know this from talking to people who go through our programs, is to actually say to ourselves, hang on a sec, what's going on? Is to think through, my goodness, you know, I come to work, you know, I immerse myself in work. I come home. I'm so exhausted. I immerse myself in the chair at home. What am I actually doing for my health? What am I actually doing? How many minutes out of my day am I allocating to my health? Now, in case you think that I'm a sort of a, you know, when I say health, I mean going to the doctor. That's not at Mayo. We don't think about patients in that degree of constraint. A patient is a person. We have emotional lives. We have relationships. We have an intellectual life. That's all part of health. And so when I say step back and think about our health, what I'm talking about is, you know, how many minutes a day am I devoting to my kids? You know, working with my kids and I have to tell you, today is like an amazing day for me. My daughter, I've got to tell you this. Sorry, I know I'm on radio and it's live. But I've got to tell you, it is so incredible. My daughter, my eldest daughter, Ariella, got her first piece into a public newspaper in the UK today. Her first day as a journalist. Anyway, But that is a critical part of living a neat life, is to step back in our brains, in our intellects, and say, am I on the right path for myself? Yeah. Not just in terms of my body, but in terms of my relationships, my spirituality, which is an incredible, important part of the human, in terms of my mental health. Am I doing the right thing? Okay, and you might say, okay, I see it. I'm sitting too much. I'm too sedentary in my job, in my life, in my relationships. Jim, what am I going to do? Now, the trick isn't to go sort of, you know, insane and crazy. What I often tell people is, okay, here's what I want from you. I want 10 minutes. That's what I want. I want 10 minutes every single day from you. And in that 10 minutes, whether you have chosen in your mind to take on a walk, I'm going to do a 10-minute walk before breakfast, and I'm going to build that into my day routine. Because if you can achieve that, then of course you can make it a 15-minute walk in week two or two 10-minute walks in week three. Similarly, I'm going to take 10 minutes out of my day to actually sit down and talk to my kids. Not an hour. I'm going to just take 10 minutes out of my day, and I've got two daughters, so I'm going to take 5 minutes each. I'm actually just going to talk to them for 5 minutes. Right? This isn't world-shattering. Because as soon as I start doing that, then I'm going to start talking to them for 10 minutes. And they're going to know that we have a talk every day. And it doesn't have to be intense or heavy. It's just that connection. and that I'm going to start.
Right.
And so the first step is to make a decision. What am I going to do? What am I going to start? And then to say, 10 minutes is what I'm going to devote. I'm going to do it every single day. And I have to tell you, is once you've made that mental, if you like, it's a baby step. It's the first step. And once you've taken that first step, only then can the second step follow. So whether that's that 10-minute walk before breakfast, 10 minutes with your kids, or I've always wanted to become a painter. You know what? I'm not going to sort of give up my job, obviously, right? But I'm going to go down today to the art store or to a, you know, a department store and spend $15 or $10 on a little painting kit. I'm going to do that today. And so that is exactly how we ask people to unpeel their lives. Step back, think, what is it I am going to take on to get out of this sedentary way of life in my body, in my mind, in my soul? And I'm going to give it 10 minutes starting today.
Let me get another voice involved in the conversation. We've asked Paul Holbrook to join us again. He's a certified personal trainer with a master's degree in gerontology, founder of the Gym Age Performance here in Salt Lake City. We've had him on the program before. We've been talking about movement, and so we wanted to have him back. And Paul, I wanted to just give you a sort of an opportunity to say something generally. This idea of, you've talked about how you have to, as Dr. Levine has been mentioning, change your mindset. You've talked about taking the opportunity to move. Like when you, as you say, when, if you get a, you know, a lot of times we complain about getting a crappy parking spot because we're not close enough or we forget your keys. You've talked about the importance of embrace those opportunities because it gives you a chance to move.
Yeah. First off, Dr. Levine, I'm standing.
Yeah, yeah, we should mention that. Yeah, he is standing.
I just want to
looking down
that.
On me in, right. In both ways. Yes.
Oh,
both
Paul,
of us are looking you. Down on you.
Oh, right. Paul, what a fantastic day. Fantastic.
So it's a mindset. It's a real mindset I think you have to get into, and you alluded it to it, Dr. Levine. But my wife and I, we bought a house, and it sits way up on a hill. And two of the three sales that fell through before we bought it were due to these stairs, because there's 50 stairs from the bottom of the street where the garage is up to the front door.
You know, you've counted them.
I've counted them several times.
Yeah.
But that was, when we saw that, we thought, wow, okay, there's an opportunity for us to get more physical activity. I mean, it didn't discourage us at all. But one of the points I wanted to make was, it becomes, you know, a hassle sometimes, because just the other day I went down to the garage to get my car, and I realized I had forgotten, I got the wrong set of keys.
Yeah.
And my first response was, oh, shoot, I got to go all the way back up those 50 stairs. But I immediately changed it. I thought, no, here's more activity I get to have. And I changed it. It really changed my outlook on it. You know, instead of being frustrated, I like, okay, I'm going to just pounce up those stairs, go get the other set of keys, come back down.
Yeah.
And it was no big deal. But another thing, too, is I think the movement has to be with real purpose.
Yeah.
Kind of some energy behind it, to where I think that way you also can burn more calories instead of just kind of, if you're doing some extra movement, instead of kind of taking it slow, put a spring in your step, put a little more energy into it.
Dr. Levine, talk about that if you would. A lot of the whole neat concept is this non-exercise activity, but the idea of giving it a kind of mental boost, or even as Paul mentioned, spring in your step, how important is that idea of being a little bit more purposeful in the way you move?
Oh, Doug, first of all, please, please, please call me Jim.
Okay.
The only people who call me Dr. Levine are my kids.
Okay, good.
Paul, love it. Love the 50 steps. And I love the fact you deliberately forget your keys so you can do an extra 100 steps. I think that is so cool of you. But we're touching on actually something that I believe is actually quite fundamental. Putting a spring in your step, putting purpose into your life. This is actually, you know, what is our, and again, I don't want to get, but if you think about it, what is our purpose on in the world? I mean, is it really to sort of live this sort of cyclical entity of off to work, back from work, off to work, back for work, without ever putting a smile on our faces or a spring in our step? And so this idea is exactly, I agree with Paul 100%, is we have to go to work, of course, to earn money to support our families, but we should do it in a joyous and healthy and uplifting way. And of course, you know, I've now got an afternoon meeting. Why don't I say to my boss, hey, why don't we go for a walk outside and have this meeting as walk and talk? What a purposeful way of interacting in a positive and nurturing way with somebody who's actually my work superior, so to speak. Mm. Now, what's very clever, I have to add, there is a little bit of sneakiness to this way of thinking about the world because, of course, I now go for a walk and talk meeting with my boss. My boss gets sort of a little bit of a zing from having a spring in her or his step, right? And all of a sudden, my boss is even happier with me. And so we see this a lot, Paul. We call it the neat ripple effect. If you put a little bit of purpose in your step, other people will sort of, as if infected, will purposefully follow you too. And then you sort of almost get this sort of growing mesh of joyful activity.
And imagine what that would do in the workforce. I mean, I think that, in a sense, would increase productivity just because everybody has maybe a heightened...
Yeah, like it's contagious.
It's contagious, yeah.
You know,
Go ahead, Jim. No, I'm just going to say... we've actually measured that productivity now in three different companies. In the first company we worked on, they saw their financial services company, they saw their highest ever quarterly returns when they sort of took on this sort of spring in your step, neat approach. The other three companies, and one was a 2-year randomized study, I mean sort of big time stuff, 11% increased productivity. And so there really is a win from having a dynamic, happy, spring-in-your-step, Paul, your term, workforce. Mm. And that is actually very, very powerful. And I have to add one other thing for all the corporate leaders listening to this show. The other thing that's very interesting, and I've heard this many times, we work in well over 60 corporations, is if you're trying to recruit the brightest, smartest young lady or gentleman into your company, and they come onto the work floor and they see everybody moving around, smiling, having a little bit of a joke, being healthy, and sort of wandering around in this sort of quite healthy and dynamic way, where do you think those young, dynamic, new individuals are going to want to work? They're going to want to work in that company, as opposed to the one which everyone's sort of sitting down and quite morose.
Before we run out of time, we've got to talk about what seems to be this trend going on in a lot of workspaces these days, and that is these treadmill desks. Say something, Dr. Levine, and Paul, I wanted to get you on this too, this idea of how much movement do we have to be doing? I mean, this is a question from Ben, who talks about how he came across your work, Dr. Levine, and he's gotten rid of his chair and his sitting desk, and he stands up at work all day. He's wondering about whether a treadmill at work is going to help, or if he's just standing and moving around, is that enough? And we're getting a lot of questions like that. If standing at work is not necessarily an option, are there other options? You know, what are the practical – and we don't have a lot of time left, but some of the quick practical things that you suggest.
So but when you say we don't have a lot of time, you mean like just 2 hours now, right?
Yeah, right.
No. So very, very quickly. So originally we came up with this sort of treadmill desk as almost a way of demonstrating to our patients and to the public what we're talking about. It was just an idea. And, of course, an idea became a product and a product became a revolution. And there are tens of thousands of these things. But what I have to reassure your listeners is you do not need to fork out for a treadmill desk, although I have to tell you they're now sort of in the $400, $500, $600, $700 range, which is about the same price as an office chair these days.
Yeah.
But anyway, you don't need that. And I was very cynical about this idea of standing at work. I sort of figured, that's not walking. That's not getting that doubling of metabolic rate. But how wrong I was, because we actually did studies on this. And what actually happens if you can get people up and standing at work, they inevitably then start wandering around and moving and shuffling. And it appears to be an exceedingly powerful way, not only of burning calories, but staving off those ill metabolic effects of sitting too much. So it appears to be actually quite an effective solution.
Paul.
Yeah, I suggest if having an alarm clock at your desk and every 25 or 30 minutes have it go off reminding you to just get up and get a drink or just stand up and do a couple squats or something like that, you know, and take walks at lunch, things like that. But yeah. I think movement begets movement.
Yeah.
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 And I think the more movement you do, the more movement you're going to continue to do.
That's Paul Holbrook. He's a certified personal trainer, founder of Age Performance Gym here in Salt Lake City. Paul, thanks for coming in.
Oh, thank you.
We really appreciate it. And Dr. James Levy, I call him Jim. He's the director of the Obesity Solutions Initiative at the Mayo Clinic and Arizona State University, author of the book Move a Little, Lose a Lot, joined us from Phoenix. And Jim, thank you very much for that time.
What a delight and pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard, Andy Lynn Clark. I'm Doug Fabrice.